Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Oil shale deposits in Utah, Wyoming, and Colorado are said to be 3 to 8 times as much as the oil reserves of Saudi Arabia. That's a tantalizing prospect for an energy-hungry country scrambling to wean itself off of foreign oil. But extracting oil shale is pricey, since it's not easy to turn rock into liquid. Today on the program, we're talking about the potential for oil shale extraction and the possible consequences for the environment. Joining me this hour, Jason Hansen. He's a researcher at the Center of the American West at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He's the co-author of the online report, What Every Westerner Should Know About Oil Shale. And he's joining us from the studios of KUVO in Denver this morning. Jason, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Also with us, Tim Wagner, national organizer for the Sierra Club, former director of the Utah Smart Energy Campaign at the Sierra Club, and he's joining us in studio. Tim, great to have you here.
Happy to be here.
Later on in the program, we'll hear from Jeff Hartley, who represents oil and gas companies. But first, oil shale. Do you think oil shale will solve the energy question? Or do you think oil shale mining is too expensive and destructive to be a real solution? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Before we get to the specifics of the debate over oil shale today, I do want to start with some background on this rock. The Ute Indians called oil shale the rock that burns. Jason Hansen, what exactly is oil shale?
Well, oil shale is exactly what you said. It's a rock. It is a rock that could become oil if it had a few million more years of heat and pressure to cook it and convert it into a liquid. But it hasn't had that time yet, and the idea that people have had is to speed up that process by supplying the heat ourselves.
There is a massive volume of oil shale said to be in something called the Green River Formation. Where exactly are we talking?
We're talking about the three-way border of Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado. Eastern Utah, western Colorado, and southwestern Wyoming essentially forms the Green River Formation, and that is the largest deposit of oil shale known in the world.
Tim Wagner, ecologically describe this land for us. What kind of flora, fauna call this land home?
This is an amazing area, particularly the area that I know the best here in Utah is up on the Tavaputs Plateau in a region just east and kind of northeast of the Book Cliffs area that we're all familiar with as we drive down to Moab. As you look off to the east, as you're driving on Highway 6, you can barely see up in the upper elevation, just higher peaks that can reach in places up over 9,000 feet. The Tavaputs Plateau is an amazing area of biological diversity. It has probably one of the healthiest, largest elk herds in the West, and also has one of the most viable populations of black bear as well. And so you've got a region in this area that's currently being proposed by the BLM for leasing for oil shale development that would encompass about 250,000 acres under the preferred alternative in their draft EIS.
And as you mentioned, this is public land.
It is designated, yes.
Managed by the BLM, the U.S. Forest Service.
Yes, it's all federal BLM lands. Yes, exactly.
Jason, put this into some sort of a picture of the energy supply for us. What is the volume of oil shale on this land? You say it's the largest in the world. How much are we talking? What's the equivalency for crude oil as we know it?
Well, the USGS, the U.S. Geological Survey, just completed making estimates for the three basins that are contained within the Green River Formation. And they've come up with a number of around 4 trillion barrels of oil, trillion with a T. They didn't make any attempt. Not all of that oil is going to be recoverable. Some of it's just going to be in places that it can't be recovered or it's not worth recovering. So they didn't try to put an estimate on how much of it is recoverable because no technology currently exists to recover it. But the best estimates, the best guesses, put it somewhere in the order of 6 to 8 times the proven crude supply of Saudi Arabia.
So massive amount, at least the potential is there for a massive amount. And so it's not surprising that this has stirred some excitement among commercial interests and people looking for alternatives for the fossil fuel that we get from the Middle East. And this is not the first time that there's been this kind of excitement for oil shale extraction. There was some interest in the 1920s, again in the 1980s, right?
That's right. This oil shale, since the first American settler allegedly built his fireplace and chimney out of oil shale, unfortunately, and then watched his housewarming party turn into a bad pun, oil shale's been attracting the interest of people who see in it the potential for a major new energy source for the country. You're right, there was a major boom starting in the 19-teens, right after World War One, and running through most of the 20s until it busted in the Great Depression. There was another major boom in the starting in the mid-70s and running until 1982, the infamous Black Sunday that most people who live in the area are familiar with. And there have been a couple other lesser periods of interest with oil shale. Generally, it follows a formula. When energy prices are volatile and national security anxieties are high and there is some active encouragement from the federal government, we tend to get an oil shale boom.
So when you say a boom, it's a boom in interest. It's not actually a boom in extracting oil shale and producing oil.
Sure. But by interest, we mean companies out in shale country conducting tests and building large mining sites or retorts or whatever the project calls for, hiring lots of people. It's a boom in interest, but it has not yet led to any sizable commercial production.
Jason Hansen is a researcher at the Center of the American West at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's co-author of the online report, What Every Westerner Should Know About Oil Shale, and there's a link on our website, kcpw.org. Also with us, Tim Wagner with the Sierra Club. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Jason, so describe for us what the process is. How do you get the oil-like substance out of the oil shale rock?
Well, the important thing is to add heat. And there's two ways to do that currently, two processes that companies are exploring. One is to dig the oil shale rocks out of the ground, like a traditional mining operation, and put them into something called a retort, which is just a big oven, essentially, that can heat the rocks to temperatures upwards of 600 or 700 degrees Fahrenheit. That's enough heat to liquefy the sort of proto-oil that's in oil shale and allow it to be pulled out as if it were the crude oil that we're all more familiar with. The other idea is to leave those rocks in the ground and bring the heat to them. That's called in situ development, and that's the process that most of the companies working with oil shale today are experimenting with.
So heating it in the ground to these extreme temperatures. Tim Wagner, I guess that's where you come in. Environmentalists have expressed some concern when it comes to oil shale mining. Do you want to talk about both of these processes and what are some of the risks involved as you see it?
Well, yes, certainly on the and Jason's very correct that they've got these. Basically, you have these two different processes: the above ground or the surface mining project or process. Of course, is obviously very destructive to the region because as they're looking at these huge quantities of potentially recoverable oil, they've got to mine a lot of this rock, which would cover a tremendous amount of area. And like I mentioned earlier, this is in primarily some amazing elk habitat, black bear habitat, and other biological resources that exist. Water is obviously a major concern. The in situ process, as Jason described, is also a very high concern for a lot of people because of the potential migration of the chemicals and the kerogen and the waxy substance that basically is a precursor to oil. Mm-hmm. And how do you prevent that from actually migrating and getting into underground aquifers and so forth? And then, of course, there's the water use associated with the mining process, either above ground or below ground, that many people are very, very concerned about, because this is obviously a very arid environment in a watershed of the Colorado River, which is the water supply for about 30 million people. And so obviously it's a major concern for those reasons.
801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We're talking about oil shale, the potential, the risks involved for developing it. Do you think oil shale will solve the energy question, or do you think oil shale mining is too expensive and destructive? 801-355-TALK or 801-355-8255. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Last night, hundreds attended a public meeting in Salt Lake City to comment on a plan to develop over 350 acres for oil shale and tar sands in Utah. Some estimate the oil shale under Utah, Colorado, and Wyoming amounts to at least triple the reserves of Saudi Arabia. But environmental groups say that's speculative and destructive. What are the realities of oil shale development on public lands? You can join our conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. What do you want to know about the oil shale reserves in Utah? And do you think it's the next big thing in energy, or is it a red herring? 801-355-8255. With us this hour to discuss the topic, Jason Hansen, a researcher at the Center of the American West at UC Boulder. He is co-author of the online report, What Every Westerner Should Know About Oil Shale, and he's joining us via ISDN in Denver. Also with us, Tim Wagner, an organizer for the Sierra Club here in Salt Lake City. He's in studio, and joining us now by phone is Jeff Hartley, a government affairs consultant to energy companies in Utah, including oil and gas, renewables, oil, shale, nuclear, and public utilities. He's joining us by phone. Jeff Hartley, thanks so much for your time.
You bet.
Earlier in the program, we were talking about the earlier incidents where people got very excited about oil shale and started to explore that option. They all failed. Is the failure of the past an indicator of the future when it comes to oil shale? Jeff Hartley?
Well, I would say no more so than any other industry where you've had starts and stops and efforts to bring a product to market that went through a life cycle and wasn't successful. I remember I first heard about oil shale in the mid-90s when Jim Hansen was the chairman of the House Resources Committee and held a series of hearings about oil shale. And at the time, oil was priced at about $40 per barrel, and the technologies available at the time priced the development of oil shale at about $80 per barrel, which meant it didn't make economic sense. Now you've got the reverse, where the technologies to develop oil shale are much cheaper, more around $40 a barrel, and the price of oil, as you know, is significantly higher, around $100 per barrel, which makes the economics work. You've also had a revolution in the technology, in that what used to be characterized correctly as a rather dirty technology and polluting and having water concerns and environmental concerns has been cleaned up quite a bit, and the technologies that are emerging on the market now are significantly better and address most or all of those environmental concerns.
How much are companies investing in research and development into oil shale here in Utah? Do you know?
The companies I know to date, I would say that over $100 million has been invested in the last 5 years towards proving technologies both in the lab and in the ground in Utah.
And are states subsidizing the commercial interests of oil shale in any way?
Not whatsoever. Right now, there's no subsidies for oil shale development. All of the money that's been spent in the testing so far has been private equity.
Jeff Hartley, has oil shale extraction been successful elsewhere in the world?
Yeah, in fact, in many places in the world, oil shale production has been going for quite some time. In Estonia, they've used oil shale for power, much like we use coal for power here. They've been producing oil for a number of years now as well from their oil shale. In Brazil, in China, in the Middle East, and elsewhere, they are producing oil shale, liquid oil from oil shale.
Jeff Hartley is a lobbyist for energy companies here in Utah, including oil shale companies. Tim Wagner with the Sierra Club and Jason Hansen with the Center for the American West out of Denver. We're talking about oil shale and the potential risks as well. 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go to the phones. John is joining us from Taylorsville, Utah. John, hi.
Hello. A couple of comments. I started working with the oil shale people back in about 1981, and I found three really important factors along the decades I was involved, again, off and on. And they were, one is that price point issue that was mentioned. People kept saying, well, when prices hit $50, $70, or $100 a barrel, we'll be able to develop this resource. And that never really showed up. Even in $150 a barrel, not too long ago, the industry just didn't take off. And that was because of the second factor, and that was that no matter how much the price of oil might go up worldwide, you still have the problem of the net energy cost of getting that oil out. The researchers I worked with and the commercializers and the business people never could show, they claimed it, but they could never show that you actually get more oil out after you put all the energy in. That moving the product, grinding it, processing it, often seem to consume more energy or at least as much energy as you got back. So no matter how high the price of oil goes, if it costs more energy to go in than you get out, you're never going to commercialize this stuff. And then, of course, the third factor, how do you deal with such huge quantities of dust if you bring the stuff out of the ground, or how do you account for the environmental factors of trying to cook it underground? None of the commercializer people we saw come in could actually show that they could pull it off at a commercialized level. They all brought in bench tests that showed solvent extraction could pull the oil out, but they never showed us any real cost numbers that made it go. So to wrap it up, I don't mean to be negative, but quite frankly, we're sitting on a huge amount of oil that's going to be very, very difficult to ever be cost efficient, let alone accounting for the environmental issues. Thanks a lot. I'll go off the air.
Great points, John. Thanks for the call. 801-355-8255. Jeff Hartley, I guess I need to get you to respond. First of all, the economics of it. Does it pencil out? Are you spending so much to extract this oil-like substance that it doesn't work?
Yeah, so the call actually made his point was more to the amount of energy it takes to produce a barrel of oil, which has been a criticism of oil shale in the past, and probably deservedly so. But the technology is available today. The Estonians who are bringing the technology over, they say that their energy in is about one barrel for every five barrels that they produce. Other technologies that should come online in Utah in the next couple of years are even better at about one barrel of energy equivalent in for seven barrels of production. So that has been an issue in the past because, as your caller mentioned, if it takes more energy to produce a barrel than you get out at the end product, then it makes no sense. But both the economics of cost and the energy consumption have been overcome since he was working in the industry. And then I'd just point out that, he mentioned that he was working on oil shale in the early 80s. Back when we were all working at best on the old, like a 286 PC that was slow and cumbersome and cost a lot of money. And just like computer technology has advanced to the point where we have the iPad 3 for $800, the technologies in oil shale have been aided by the revolutions in technologies of other sectors to where it's quite different than your grandfather's oil shale.
Tim Wagner, you're not buying it.
No, I'm not. A lot of the research reports and stuff that we've read clearly does not show that there's anywhere near that kind of energy return on investment for what goes into oil shale. The best research I've seen from a report that was just done just literally 2 years ago showed that at the best you're still at about 1-to-1 in terms of one barrel in, one barrel out. And that doesn't include the huge environmental costs that come with developing oil shale, whether it's surface mining, impacts to oil, impacts to water, impacts to wildlife, impacts to air quality. These things are all external costs that are borne by the public. These are still public lands, which is still a public resource. It's being utilized by private industry to make a lot of money. No, I don't buy it at all. And I want to respond to the notion that Estonia has this new process that works. Estonia is using a lot of oil shale for power production. They burn it, just like coal. They mine the rocks, throw it in these big boilers, and they burn it, just like coal. That's not developing a fuel. Yeah, there may be some technologies out there to get more fuel out of the rock, but it hasn't been proven. And that's why the BLM has taken a much more slow-go approach on this, saying if you guys can develop the stuff, this is what we're going to let you do. But until you can prove it, come back and come back and then talk, and we'll talk some more.
Jason Hansen, is that the research that you have seen, does it show that the energy costs are, you know, are 1-to-1? We've been referring to this Estonian company, Enefit, which is doing some work in Vernal. What do we know about the process that they're using there?
Well, first of all, I think what we're hearing is one of the things that we'll say makes the potential for oil shale development so interesting. There's a lot of room right now for legitimate disputes over the data. And in part, that's because many of the companies are playing their energy return numbers and all other sorts of numbers very close to the vest right now as they go through the RD&D process, because they don't want to be pegged to numbers that they think that maybe down the road they can improve upon. So one of the problems that we run into, one of the problems that Tim and I and anyone who is trying to figure out what's going on with oil shale runs into, is most of the really good studies were done in the last boom. And everything that's coming out now is much more speculative. And so it's hard to use numbers from so long ago. It's essentially shooting behind a moving target if you do that. But there's a lack of really solid data to know exactly what we're talking about. We end up hearing from companies that the technology is getting better. We might get hints about how it's getting better, but we don't know the specifics, really, of how it's getting better in terms of water usage, in terms of energy input to output. To the second part of your question about Enefit, Enefit is indeed the state energy company of Estonia. They've been mining oil shale for close to a century and using it mainly to produce electricity, just like Jeff said. They burn it in a process sort of similar to coal. They do produce a little bit of liquid oil from this process, but most of that goes right back into the energy generation cycle. They're proposing here a large surface mine operation, something similar to what they have in Estonia, but much larger, a generation ahead of what they've got, and focused on retorting the fuel in oil shale into a liquid fuel here in the United States. Enefit has something like 30,000 acres assembled in Utah already, and of that, over 20,000 of those acres are private. So Enefit is moving ahead, trying to get approval to work on its federal lease, because that's the richest deposits it's got. But it has plenty of acreage that it owns privately that it can move ahead on. So they are looking at they claim that they are going to have commercial capacity by 2018, whether that's on private or public land.
Jason Hansen with the Center of the American West at the University of Colorado Boulder, Tim Wagner with the Sierra Club, and Jeff Hartley, a government affairs consultant to energy companies, including oil shale companies. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We're talking about oil shale and oil shale development, the potential, the risks associated with that. Let's go back to the phones, and I believe it's Donald joining us from Salt Lake. This is Tim. Excuse me. Tim in Salt Lake. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go right ahead.
You know, every time I hear these discussions of these new extractive methods for getting oil, it reminds me of when you see stories about junkies that are, you know, picking the scabs off their feet because they've run out of veins for injecting themselves. You know, it just seems awfully desperate. I mean, I find it really hard to believe if we actually accounted in addition for the normal environmental costs, you know, the additional carbon costs of extracting this and continuing to burn fossil fuels as an energy source, that any of this would be even vaguely cost-effective, particularly in light of, you know, you look at how much sun and wind is no doubt also in the Colorado Plateau and similar areas. And I'll take my answer or response off the phone. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, Tim. Jeff Hartley, do you want to respond to that? The environmental cost of oil shale is just too high. You know, we're burning things, we're creating dust, we're scarring the land.
Well, I guess I would first say that for those environmentalists who just are anti-carbon, and there are many who make claims that we just need to move away from fossil fuels entirely, you'll never convince those folks that oil shale is a good idea. But for those who understand that we're going to need liquid fuels for a long time in the future, and that producing them in the Middle East or in other countries will be less environmentally sensitive than producing them domestically, not to mention the energy security issues and other things, and not to mention the jobs and the economics of the state of Utah. Oil shale is, like I said before, this is not your grandfather's oil shale. It's very different technology that's emerging today. And your other commenter was correct that the science, the studies that are being looked at now are from the last generation and don't include current technologies, primarily because they're private companies that are protecting their IP at this point until they're commercialized and more out there in the public. And so you've got a new generation that's coming online. And I guess I would say to the oil shale detractors, I would hope that they would take a step back and say, what if we address the environmental concerns, and what if we address the water consumption and the energy consumption and a lot of the waste disposal and other concerns of the past? What if we were able to do it in a clean way? Would it then make sense to go after the 1.8 trillion recoverable barrels of oil that we have in Utah? To a lot of us, that makes sense. And again, I would just ask, if you can address those environmental concerns, then would it be okay, or is it just that it's a fossil fuel and therefore not acceptable?
Tim, thanks so much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Donald has been waiting in Salt Lake City. Donald, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. Go right ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just interested in maybe getting an answer to why we continue to continually rape and rob the planet of what sustains us and continue to try to figure out a better way to continue to use oil, as opposed to putting those dollars into a more alternative, a more earth-friendly type of mechanism or fuel or what have you. Just something that falls a little more in line with our species being able to sustain a little longer on this planet, because it seems to be to me that we're trying to find a way to turn rock, to polarize a rock down into fuel when it's very free and abundant from the sun. You know, and I may be a little bit off, you know, as far as what we use those, you know, how we use those fuels, but, you know, it just seems to be to me that we continually are moving backwards if we're continuing to try to find different ways to still be dependent on oil.
Donald, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK. Jeff Hartley, I guess, again, you're in the hot seat. Why not invest in solar? Why not invest in alternative renewable energy instead of pouring a lot of money down this oil shale?
Actually, I appreciate the question. I also do work with renewable companies, and in fact, there is a great effort in the West right now to bring our renewables online. There are wind resources scattered throughout the state. They're not great. We have in wind, when you measure this, the capacity of a wind resource, it's on a scale of 1 to 5, and five being the best. And we have some areas of 5-category wind in Utah, and there are companies that are actively going after developing wind farms to capture that. It might be worth noting that the largest industrial owner of wind power in the United States is the parent company of Rocky Mountain Power. They have a tremendous amount of wind across the U.S., including in Wyoming. Solar is also coming online in Utah. The cost is still higher than what the fair market wants to pay, but it's coming down. The technology is getting better. The costs are coming down, and you're seeing more solar being looked at. We've had some activity in rooftop solar in the Salt Lake Valley, and we're looking at some solar construction projects out in some of the desert country. But again, it's got to be the right. You have to have two things. You have to have a good resource where it's actually a high capacity for solar, but also the ability to get those electrons onto the grid and transmit them to where they can be used. And all of that costs a lot of money. It costs about $1 million per mile to string power lines. And so all these things cost money, but they are being worked on currently. It's just we're kind of in, to me, that it seems like we're kind of on the verge of a new frontier of energy here in Utah and in the surrounding states, where you're going to see a lot of these resources coming online in various capacities. And it's being driven by new technology that makes all of them more affordable and better.
I want to bring the BLM back into this discussion. The land, much of the land where we find oil shale is public land. At the direction of President Obama, the BLM wants to scale back the acreage available for oil shale leasing in Utah, Wyoming, and Colorado, trimming it back from 1.8 million acres to, under this new plan, 462,000 acres. The BLM is currently accepting public comment on this adjustment. Tim Wagner, what do you think of the plan, the new plan?
Well, I think it's certainly a step in the right direction. The BLM's preferred alternative, which actually is not the actual alternative that we are actually supporting, but I will describe it in the essence of, in the context of where it's going. The BLM certainly has looked at this, and they're very concerned about this becoming another speculative boom and bust, as we saw the last time this go around, and rightfully so. So what they are proposing is, like you mentioned, just under 500,000 acres for leasing that would be just for research and development only and not for commercial leasing. We, the Sierra Club and other conservation groups, are actually supporting Alternative 3, which basically restricts the amount of leasing lands available to what's currently being leased by the industry for projects that are ongoing. And the reason for that is the fact that we're saying, look, to the industry, until you prove that this is a viable resource, you cannot do that on whether it's 30,000 acres, 500,000 acres, or 2 million acres. Prove it first and then come back and we'll talk some more. But until they can do that, they don't need 500,000 acres to prove that this stuff is a reliable source. It's more about speculation. And that's a very key point that I'd like to discuss. The fact is that oil and gas industry for years and years have been using public land leases as assets on their profit and loss statement, and rightfully so. They can do that for viable sources of energy. They could never use leases for tar sands and oil shale because of the uncertainty. That was changed by the SEC in 2010, and since then we've seen this huge renewed interest by companies wanting to come in and secure these large leases for public lands where they can speculate the amount of oil that's possibly available. And that's all for just simply attracting investors or holding on to those leases, then flipping them 2 or 3 years down the road. So is this more a discussion about energy and jobs, or is it a discussion about profits for Wall Street? That's really what we need to be having a discussion about.
Jeff Hartley, I'd like to get your response on the speculation aspect of this. it does have a compelling ring to it because nothing has been shown to be profitable yet. What do you think about the new leasing plan and about the speculation aspect of it?
Well, on the new leasing plan, the construction of what's been currently available, I don't speak for Enefit, so I'll use them as an example. They have a lease, one of the RD&D leases. There are only five in the country that the BLM has put out, and they have one of them. It's the only one in Utah. It's part of their lease includes what's called the White River Mine, which is a deep underground mine, which has been proven to have just a vast amount of oil shale in it. The reason why they need more acreage and more shale available is if they're looking at investing a few billion dollars into their infrastructure for their retort, and to be able to make that pencil, they need to know that there's enough resource available. Once they build it, they'll be able to, you know, keep making money off of that and cover that investment over time. When the BLM says we're only going to lease a certain amount, then the company has to look at it and say, will there be enough shale available over time for us to make this an economical investment? And that's something that they have to wrestle with as they look at the constriction, because what the BLM has proposed, their preferred option is a significant scale back to what was available to Enefit when they bought that option from the previous owner. And the other option that the environmental groups would prefer would offer even less opportunity for them to make the economic pencil work. Now, to the argument that they need to prove it first, to some extent that makes sense, that we should prove these technologies before we open up all of the federal lands. The problem is there's so little available that you're not really going to have a competitive marketplace where a lot of companies are investing in different technologies to see if any of them can work. It's pretty restrictive that way, and in my opinion, the BLM did it more to offer up the sacrificial lamb in an election year to the environmental groups than for any other reason. But that's because I'm fairly partisan and look at this more politically than economically.
I'm glad you're honest with your partisanship. 801-355-TALK is our number. Again, we're talking about oil shale development in Utah. Our time is short. I want to sneak in one more call. Mary from Salt Lake City. Mary, hi.
Hi, I read in the newspaper 2 weeks ago that in Ohio they had a dozen earthquakes that were attributed to this gas drilling, wastewater in the earth.
Okay, Mary, thanks so much. I guess Jason Hansen, is this the fracking, or is this have to do with oil shale?
This is an important thing to talk about. No, it doesn't have to do with oil shale, but it is incredibly confusing and unnecessarily so. So it makes sense that Mary heard it that way. Oil shale is, as we've been talking about, a rock with a waxy proto-oil bound in it. When we're talking about fracking and gas drilling, we're talking about shale oil and shale gas. You reverse the words. The essential difference is that when we're fracking, when companies are fracking, they are using the fracking process to bring oil that is already liquid to the surface. It's just trapped in a whole bunch of tiny little pockets, little bubbles underground, and the fracking helps free those little bubbles to bring them to the main pipeline and up, and same with gas. So what's going on in Ohio is different. What's going on all over the West when you hear about fracking is in many ways essentially different from what we're talking about with oil shale.
I'm glad Mary brought that up, because it is very confusing when we talk about all of these different energy sources. Our time is short, but the BLM is taking public input on these lease options until May 4th. I guess I'd like each of you just to respond on, you know, what are the next steps? If the BLM goes ahead and approves scaling back these the oil shale leasing, what's the next move for industry, for the environmental groups? Jason Hansen, your thoughts first.
Well, I think if the BLM goes ahead and adopts the new environmental impact statement, and it should be noted they're doing this new process as the result of a settlement with a coalition of environmental groups who sued over the last process, the last environmental impact statement and the leasing rules. For some reasons we probably don't need to go into, but this is sort of a legal requirement that they're doing. They're not just doing it as election year candy necessarily, although it does align more closely with Secretary of Interior Salazar's longtime views. I think if this is adopted in the short and intermediate term, we don't see any significant change. The leases are still operating. There's still a second round of leasing underway, of which three companies have applied for leases. One of them is ExxonMobil, so there's still some interest there. There's still private lands, especially in Utah, that are viable for producing oil shale. Sure, the industry would love to have a much broader canvas to look at when they're trying to figure out how to make their economics pencil, but in the short and intermediate term, I think if this environmental impact statement is adopted in place of the previous one, we won't notice a large change in shale country.
Is that your assessment, Jeff Hartley, that industry will continue to research oil shale and look into more development opportunities on private land?
That's correct. Jason's right. Enefit's the only company currently on BLM land, the only one affected by what the BLM's proposing. The other companies looking at oil shale in Utah are on private land or on school and institutional trust land, and so they're not affected by the BLM's decision. And I missed responding to the question about the marketplace and it actually ties into this point. So far in Utah, the only investors in oil shale development are private equity. They're not publicly traded companies that are investing in Utah. But you do have ExxonMobil and some others in other states, but in Utah, it's all been private capital so far. And these are companies that have looked at the technology and decided that it's worth investing hundreds of millions of dollars in proving this resource out.
And Tim Wagner, briefly, where do we go from here?
Well, I think I think they're both right in that that you won't see a whole lot of change. The companies, the legitimate companies that are actually trying to develop this resource, will continue to go forward. I think the process that the BLM is trying to put in place here is to allow a controlled type of situation where we don't see another speculative boom and bust, which hurts a lot of people. I think they're also looking at, obviously, the environmental consequences, make sure we have something that's can be done viably and safe for the environment, for the health of the American people. And, you know, that's probably a responsible approach at this point. At the same time, we need to be putting more energy, resources into clean, renewable energy, and that's the future. It really is truly the future.
And again, the BLM taking comment until May 4th. There will be a link on our website, kcpw.org, on just how to do that. Tim Wagner with the Sierra Club, Jason Hansen with the Center for the American West, joining us from Denver, and Jeff Hartley, a government affairs consultant for energy companies here in Utah. Gentlemen, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Up next, the Utah artist Mary Toscano on her latest exhibit. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City.